Hello and welcome to episode 86 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Cookie.
And this week we are joined by Laura Rich, who previously hosted the Ready Up podcast and has recently joined Expansive DLC.
Hello.
As ever, you can find the show notes for this episode at www.nerdassemble.co.uk, where you can comment and find links to our social accounts. Plus, you can get in touch and ask questions or comment on the show by email at contact@nerdassemble.co.uk. And also, you can listen to us on Stitcher and iTunes. You don't just have to download. And please, if you are vaguely interested in writing some content about stuff you love, that's kind of geeky, Hex Dimension is still looking for contributors, and you can find a link for that in the show notes. But Paul, what's going on this week?
Well, this week, E.T. has been found in New Mexico landfill. Netflix subscription price is to go up. The extended Star Wars universe has been dropped. And an interview with Opposable Games' Nat Al-Tahan.
But first, E.T.'s been found in New Mexico.
Yay!
Kinda.
It's such a cool story.
We first talked about this way back in episode 42, which was about 10 months ago, according to the website. And basically, the team, the Canadian documentary team, having eventually got permission, that I've heard the reason it took so long is because they actually managed to get a deal through with Microsoft for partly funding the whole thing. And that it was the wrangling over that that's delayed the dig. But the dig's finally started the past week. And not only have they found old, was it Atari 2600 copies of the E.T. game, they found a lot more as well in the bottom of this landfill. And there's a lot of stuff. I mean, it's not just the bad, which is E.T., obviously. There's actually some good games got chucked in there as well, by the looks of things.
Asteroids.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yep. That's
quite ironic, really, if you think about it.
Yeah, having an excavation, almost archaeological excavative dig, and you find Raiders of the Lost Ark in there. There's a slight poetry to that, I will admit.
I'm thinking, when I read the story, like, it doesn't matter what you find in a dig, it's treasure. Like when you're a kid and you're in the garden and you find like a bottle cap, that's treasure. What a fun day they must have had.
It would have been amazing.
They beat me to it. I used to like
kids
digging around in my grandparents' front garden that they used to have in their small holding, because admittedly it might have been like a rubbish tip at some point during the Victorian era, but it's fine because I could find tons of broken pottery. Put lots of plates back together, which is quite fun. God, what else did they chuck in there? There was some Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man made it in there.
Oh, that's just rude.
Berserk.
It's just
Breakout and Super Breakout.
Yeah.
I think basically, because I remember back in episode, was it 42, and Retroid described the harrowing meltdown of Atari and perhaps the games industry at that point in time in 82. And E.T. was a crap game, but the fact that there were other casualties of war as well, and in a way, I suppose Atari didn't recover to the same heady levels afterwards either.
It does make me think I wouldn't be surprised to see most of these on eBay soon.
I've heard that there might be some interesting price fluctuations going on for copies that have been retrieved from the dig site. But the thing is having to describe the copies.
Yeah, they need to be damaged to sell for a higher price to prove that they were actually from the landfill.
Maybe.
There'll be people smashing them up.
Because you'd want like rubble on them, wouldn't you?
Yeah. But the thing is that not only were they, like, because it was a proper dumping site, so like a proper landfill site, so there were not just the games in there, but there was just regular rubbish up on top. So I wouldn't like to speculate on the overall hygiene levels for
you'll
the
get a banana skin or something.
Apparently, it was a good thing, though, that they were buried out in the middle of the New Mexican desert, because that meant they've actually been quite well preserved, you know, due to that place's general lack of rain, you know, kind of a slight sort of nice dry conditions, maybe a bit dusty, but generally dry.
Which is cool.
Does make me wonder, when you actually finally buy a copy through eBay, will it still reek of landfill?
It might actually come with as part of the landfill as a free gift.
I wonder if it's possible...
Buy two, get this free.
I wonder if it's possible for cardboard to become sort of cremated with like a sort of slight bit of methane. So that means that the items from there are actually slightly more combustible than normal. Because, you know, rubbish.
They have to ship them in a glass container that just keeps everything nice.
I mean, on here, it says it actually differentiates between the differences of Defenders cartridges. One's the Atari 2600 and the other one's Atari 5200.
Mm.
So, obviously, it was just anything. They were like, we can't sell this, we can't sell this. It's all gone wrong. Bung it in a hole. But it's a long list, and we'll link to it in the show notes.
I wonder if any of the staff had a bookie running on how long it'd be before somebody dug it up.
I wonder if there's anyone left to have been keeping score on that bet.
See, we could have done a Goonies adventure out there to find that. Missed our opportunity there.
But you'd have to, because there's the whole bureaucracy of getting permission to just go and dig in the landfill site. It's also actually quite dangerous to dig in the landfill site.
I should imagine so, yeah.
Goonies, we don't need permission. It's all right.
But the methane is a genuine issue. Like, it could explode. Like, true. you could like be just kind of just thinking that you're just powering down free with your digger, and then obviously the metal more of it just kind of catches against it, and there's just a spark, and then boom.
Oh.
What would happen is I'd have an absolute horrendous moment. I'll just light a cigar up and pretend that I'm Hannibal Smith from the A-Team. That'll be it. Boom.
I'm gonna move us on to our next story, which is a bit closer to this time and place, and that's the news that Netflix subscriptions will have their prices going up in the near future. They haven't said when. They haven't officially said when either. They haven't officially stated anything. It was just came out in an investors call when they were doing their financials recently.
Have they said how much it's going up to? Or?
The estimate so far of that is that the price will remain under £10 and is most likely to be around £7.
Hmm.
Oh, that's not so bad.
I'm just wondering whether they're going to reinvest the extra money into the business.
Well, they said that they want to use the money to buy more rights to things and to also develop more original content.
Oh, good.
Which
is cool.
Yeah. And
I like that idea.
I do too, especially when they're doing things not just like House of Cards, which I'm talking about in a bit. But also the fact that they've got the whole Marvel series that they're teaming up with Marvel. Yeah.
Yes.
And so hopefully that means they can invest in more things like that.
I think the one problem is that because Netflix are obviously doing their own shows as well, and Love Film or Amazon are doing their own shows, and it's like, well, it kind of means that some people have to wait until the DVD versions to actually get, you know, the other person's shows, if you know what I mean.
How much was it Amazon Prime Video?
Yeah.
How much does that work out a month now, since all the changes?
Is that not free with Prime?
I'm not sure if it's free with Prime. If you want to have the separate subscription, I'm assuming you can still do like
you can get it separate.
At least I hope you can get it separate. I mean, I haven't looked at it since I used to have
a Prime member.
Do you have to be a Prime member? Because that'd just be the, you know.
But this is Amazon we're talking about.
This is true. They have just managed to help screw up the Comixology app over the course of the weekend. I suppose I'll mention it now, just because in connection with Netflix. So Netflix, okay, I would say they're a company that are doing things well at the moment. Then on the other end, we've got Amazon, who not only tried to give people video who didn't want video, pretty much with the Prime account stuff, but also have managed, since their acquisition of Comixology the other week, have managed to get them to update the app so that in-app purchases in the iOS version are no longer possible. And it is possible on Android, but if you're in the UK, it's in dollars rather than pounds now.
You can no longer pay by Google Wallet.
And have obviously that extra step of like being asked for a password before a purchase is made. which is, you know, kind of a bit of a pain. It's like, yes, let the small child near near the device. In a way, it's safer to allow your kids to read comics on an iOS device at the moment than it is on an Android device, because at least on the iOS one, they can't buy it. They've got to go to the website to buy them, and obviously that involves more chances of logging in a password and card details and that, whereas on Android, it could be just like, let's just press the button. Buy all the comics. No, don't buy all the comics. It'll cost a small fortune. And when I bought a test comic yesterday, where I bought an issue of Iron Man that I haven't bought yet, it was listed as $3.99 within the app.
Yep.
The receipt that came through to my Google account, well, my Google email address, said £3.99. I'm like, seeing as how I was paying around £2.49 for new comics through it prior to this change, I hope they don't continue this straight up non-actual currency, you know, converted prices, because that's just, yeah.
That's just crazy and stupid.
And unfair as well, because $3.99 is not £3.99.
I can understand why they've done it on iOS, because I knew it was going to happen on iOS. I had no hesitation in the fact that it would happen. But why on Android? There was no reason to take off Google Wallet.
Because Google still gets 30%, I think, of the cut through Google Wallet. It's like PayPal. You know, they take a cut when you pay through them.
Yeah, but that's one of the payment options that's been put on there. That's what I didn't get.
I'm writing an opinion piece about it that's a bit more in-depth for Hex. But yeah, going back to Netflix.
Which I've written an opinion piece on Hex as well. Yay, plugs!
Their logic for putting up the subscription prices was like, okay, well, it means basically we can invest in content. But their justification was that they recorded profits of $53 million for their previous financial year, which are $32 million. And that their total global membership has gone up to 48 million accounts. So they're like, well, we should, you know, probably take a bit more extra money and kind of expand further, I assume. Because they really want to... I think one of the quotes I saw was, you know, from one of their board members or whatever, going, you know, they want to catch up to HBO for subscription numbers, which I think means that they have to treble the numbers they've currently got in order to give, like, or almost treble the numbers they've currently got in order to give HBO a run for its money.
To be honest, admittedly, you're the one that's paying for a Netflix subscription, but in theory, I don't mind paying more as long as the, you know, business expands and, you know, get more content.
Yeah.
But I think...
Especially the original content.
I think I'm correct in thinking that in the past week or so, HBO inked a deal with Amazon Prime to have content on their video service. However, it's debatable as to when shows will actually come online and stuff. And you could be waiting up to 3 years for some shows.
That's a long old wait.
That is.
So, yeah, it's not... everything gets cracked up to be in theory, so but I just like Netflix because it's not associated really with anything else. I mean, the reason I've been holding out from subscribing to like Now TV, even though it would mean I could watch Game of Thrones nearer to its original broadcast date, is because Now TV is essentially a front for Sky. So
I know it's quite bad, but I like being able to watch stuff in bulk.
I need to do that. I lose interest otherwise.
I suppose that's why Breaking Bad managed to do so well here, was because we had the whole seasons available on Netflix once they made them available. So everyone was just like, just watch the whole lot.
There again, I mean, DVD sales, I would imagine, would account for some of it. Part of the problem is that, you know, in order to kind of take a risk on a series that you've never watched, really you kind of need like an episode or two to kind of... see if you can get into it.
Do you know, if the story is true that Netflix chooses what content to onboard by looking at what's been torrented and streamed legally the most, one series I'd love to be able to see again would be Clerks, the animated series. So I'm not advocating the illegal obtaining of content, but actually you can't buy it on disc over here in region 2. So, you know, if you want to help make that reality, you know, or in fact, if you just know, like, somebody big at Netflix, just get going, talk to Kevin Smith's people, get some Clerks animated series on there.
Well, I mean, you say Kevin Smith's people, but I think part of the problem is that when people produce content like that, technically the rights are owned by the company that put the money in.
Mind you, if ITV2 can get their blimmin' sticky paws on Clerks the Animated Series to show the blimmin' thing, I'm sure Netflix must be able to. They can get their hands on Kevin
Chances
Spacey.
Are they can. It just depends on whether they deem it as justifiable for the price.
They have had some Smith stuff on Netflix, though. I'm pretty sure. I didn't imagine seeing Clerks on there once, did I?
I'm pretty sure I've seen Chase and Amy on there.
Yes.
Chase and Amy's definitely on there.
So the View Askew universe has precedents on there. I'm going to move us on to our final news story of the week.
Are you sure you want to?
I would say that I don't have that much invested in this particular subject.
Well, I fucking well do.
But I know of a lot of angry people who do.
I think I'm going to create a rule. Nobody can use a swear word with the letter U in there.
Really?
Oh, but those are my favourite ones.
That's a bit harsh.
No, just it's more of a challenge.
More of a challenge?
Yeah, challenging your vocabulary.
It's going to be more of a challenge to get through this piece without foaming at the mouth.
And chewing off his own hand.
I don't know any of the Star Wars Extended Universe, so I need to hear why this is bad.
Oh. I'm a bit more of a neutral party in terms of my general awareness of it, in that I've played maybe a couple of the games and know of the existence of a huge back catalogue of novels, comics, novels, and tabletop role-playing that tie in with the, or previously tied in with the canon of the existing films.
I mean, aren't there like some of the games as well?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure whether all of the games are technically canon.
No, the game, everything ever officially created was meant to be canon. That's the thing with the extended universe.
That's what's made it so unique.
Yeah, it was so unique. And then just them saying, no, we're dropping it. And it's like, and this is something that's been built up over, what, like 30 odd years. And it's just kind of like, because we've got. It's
stupid.
It's painful. I can see it's painful for fans.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's just taken everything out of context.
I mean, surely the most logical thing to do would basically just not say anything about the extended universe and kind of go on.
Well, problem is that I can't see that you can really do that, because the books, even some of the games, have had some events that have changed the dynamic of some of the main characters in the films.
So basically they're doing what Star Trek did, but without like a creative part in the film to explain why.
Yeah.
It just disappears.
Yeah.
It just disappears. So Luke Skywalker's wife, son, I'm assuming, disappears. Leia and Han Solo's marriage disappears. So do they.
Oh, they got married.
Yeah, and they had twins.
Aw.
The whole new Jedi Academy, with pretty much all the Skywalker family, disappears. That's it. I'm going to go cry now.
Everything's disappearing. Was it Simon Kinberg, who's working on the Star Wars Rebels series? He's an executive producer. He was, as I've described in my notes, the canary that stated things weren't looking good for the extended universe after saying in an interview, you know, it's not off limits and it's certainly inspiring. I'm working on an animated show for Lucasfilm as well, Star Wars Rebels, that will take inspiration from everywhere, but I know for the movies, the canon is the canon, and the canon is the 6 films that exist.
So how are they going to tie in this new cartoon? Because the Rebels cartoon series is supposed to set up events from episode 3 to episode 4, New Hope. So if they're using the extended universe to help bring that in, because there is quite a few characters that have appeared in graphic novels and stuff that have helped develop the characters ready for the New Hope, it just isn't going to make sense.
I think,
because you're going to be contradicting yourself come bloody episode 7 when they decide that Darth Vader's alive and well and he's actually married to Minnie Mouse.
From what it sounds like to me is that they've basically said the canon doesn't exist in, as in, outside like, outside films. Of the films, but we're going to use some of the ideas, which is kind of having it, having your cake and eating it. It's kind of sort of like saying, yeah, we can do what we want, so because, you know, we don't have to kind of bother with this extended universe, but
what's we're most
take, you know, from it.
Yeah, what's most insulting about the whole thing is the way the official statement then goes on to describe what is happening with the existing extended universe, which will apparently, in any reissues of it now, fall under the Legends sub-franchise. Legends. So thus, just to further alienate it from being canon,
so they're going to do like DC with Earth on Earth 2, Marvel with the Ultimate Universe and everything else.
I wouldn't say they'd actively pursue it. I think as if they decide there's money in something, it'll be issued under that, you know, subtitle basically.
It should all be one.
In the official statement on the StarWars.com website, after Kimbo's comments were released, they said, in order to give maximum creative freedom to the filmmakers and also preserve an element of surprise and discovery for the audience, Star Wars Episode 7 to 9 will not tell the same story told in the post-Return of the Jedi expanded universe. While the universe that readers knew is changing, it is not being discarded. And then they go on to explain the Legends thing.
The thing is, though, they don't need they to keep the creativity in there. They didn't need to discard it because, putting it politely, you couldn't really have some of the adventures that have been written in the stories anyway, because that's when all the main guys like Luke Han and Leo are still quite relatively young. They're going to be quite old when they come to filming, so they can't dress that up anyway. So they could actually use some of those events to help build a new story.
Yeah, but I think part of the problem is, though, is that they probably recognise that there's going to be some Star Wars fans out there that have not read the novels, that have not played the games, that have not done anything else apart from watch the six main, you know, films. And they probably don't want to alienate them by basically just plunging them into a, you know, brand new situation where everything's changed, but they're having to kind of forcefully explain what's kind of happened in between.
Yeah, I could see your point to a degree on that one, but it's still...
I do wonder that, because there's also the issue of if they tried to use any of the material from that being sort of created since the 1980s as part of the expanded universe, and obviously there's, depending on the contracts that were signed by creators when this was done, that's potentially a lot, you know, there's a lot of rights holders.
Yeah, that's true.
And that would be messy to sort out.
Mm.
Basically, but then at the same time, they have to surely be careful if they end up using a scenario that is similar to something from the expanded universe that was from somebody who did retain some rights when they created whatever book or comic or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be weird because the rumour is that the new film will focus on it's either Han and Leia's or Luke's kids anyway. They'll be the new heroes of the trilogy.
But
to keep that continuity. So that's what really threw me, because they've already got the kids in the extended universe. So now they're going to have just brand new kids, which is going to be bizarre.
Can I just ask, I mean, in terms of like, because, you know, the first, well, the prequel trilogy kind of dealt with the rise of the Empire. Obviously, the original trilogy dealt with kind of the fall of the Empire. In the expanded universe, you know, kind of where does like the Empire or, you know, the political situation stand?
The political situation in the first quite a few books, there were still some remnants of the Empire out there that wanted to get back in and take control.
Okay.
In fact, that's how, should I say it? That's how Luke met his future wife, because she actually turned out to be the Emperor's personal assassin, which was pretty cool. And then it's gone on to do other things like the setting up of the new Jedi Academy and how some might have been swayed to the dark side and the good side, and how they've been able to control, you know, better teach them how not to give in, which has been quite nice. And then you've had a new enemy that's appeared on the horizon from another galaxy far, far away. They've been a bit stunned because the Force doesn't affect them, because all their ships and everything are organic and they're from a different universe. So the Force doesn't actually relate to them like it does in the films.
Is it species 8472?
No, it's...
sorry.
It's very complicated. Yongvong or something like that, I think it's called.
Okay.
I would love to be able to pronounce it, but no, I'm not going to be able to. So that's how it's sort of gone. So there've been all these sort of new enemies and new political enemies in the background, that sort of thing.
I'm going to move on, but if you want to read about more bitterness and betrayal over this whole matter, David Hurd has written a lovely piece on Hex this week, which there'll be a link for in the notes. So, you know.
Which I totally agree with.
Yeah. It was just like, because the whole official statement happened after he'd written the main body of the post, and there was just like this, he just did this bitter update after all of it, just kind of going, I hate
just
it.
Just one thing, though. I hate it all. If the games aren't going to be included in this, does that mean we're actually going to be saved from having an official tie-in movie game?
No,
not
actually.
Necessarily.
They might just make a new one that does tie in.
No, you're not allowed. That's what it's not allowed. Ha ha.
Okay, before we move on to our next section, I just want to give a quick mention to James B. Willard, whose indie comic series, Penny Balabras, is currently on Kickstarter trying to raise...
What was that? Penny...
Palabras. That's how I think it should be pronounced. It's how it's spelled, as far as I'm concerned. He's currently trying to raise funds for it to have a physical graphic novel print via Kickstarter funding. It's actually a reasonable series. I've done a review with Lucy for the first issue, and I've had a good flick through the subsequent issues that they've released digitally. And it's quite weird, but kind of cool. It, as I've put in my notes, it's like Buffy crossed with Alan Wake, not Rake, with a drop of Medium. And there will be a link to the campaign in the notes. They're pretty close, though. I think they were over $1,500, if I think they're like $2,000 goal, or $2,000 of the $2,500 goal. So, but no, it's looking pretty good. So, yeah, and expect extra shipping for outside of the US. That'd be something I would also mention. But anyway, I want us to talk about what we've all been up to this past week, what we've been playing, reading, watching, or whatever. So, dear Laura, what have you been up to?
I've been playing a lot of Dark Souls 2. I actually just finished it today, and I kind of feel a bit lost, because I wasn't expecting to finish it. I didn't realize I was fighting the final boss, because I was just kind of exploring around, and I was trying to, I knew I was close to the end, but I was looking for like all the bonfires, and I was like going back to areas I'd been to before, because sometimes there's different things there or different characters there. And so I'm having this fight, and it's kind of an easy fight, only because my character's super overpowered now. And then there's this cutscene and it ends, and I'm like, oh, this is the end. Like, I finished Dark Souls 2, and I'm like, I wanted this game to last me for, I mean, it's still going to last me forever. But, you know, when you just finally, you've finished, you've seen the ending, it's kind of like, it was quite emotional. But yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Dark Souls quickly made its way to my favorite game of all time. And the second one isn't quite as, I mean... It's great. It's a 10 out of 10. It's a brilliant game, but it hasn't quite got that edge that Dark Souls had for me. Like, Dark Souls was just this, you know, this perfect experience that I had. So, but yeah, it's brilliant. It's really fun.
Is it as hard as people make out?
Well, see, I can't answer that, because I played Dark Souls a couple of times, and that was really, really hard. And then I'm playing Dark Souls 2, and I'm finding it easy. Not easy, but, you know.
Easier,
like,
yeah.
I sound like a bit of a knob saying Dark Souls 2 is easy. It's not easy, right? But because I know how to play the Souls games, it's easier for me to get through it. So someone come into Dark Souls 2 that has never played any of them would probably struggle with it, and would probably have that, you know, really rewarding experience of, you know, having to really battle the way through the game. So, yeah, I doubt it's easy at all.
Have you ever rage quit? the game at all.
I don't rage quit.
You don't rage quit?
I kind of... No, I'm not, like, very ragey. I will stop, but I more just, like, blame myself and get sad. Like, oh, I can't do this, and turn it off, and then I'll go away and do something else and come back to it and be like, oh, I was just, you know, not trying hard enough or doing the wrong thing, you know, rolling the wrong way. Just like, it's just, everyone says that it's tough but fair, and it's so true. It's just, you have to play it the way it wants you to play it, but you can also play it your own way. You can get around that. There are a million options, but there are ways to do it perfectly, like fighting a boss without taking a single hit is just the best feeling ever, especially when you're doing a low-level playthrough where you don't put points into any of your stats. So your health bar is really low. So if you can take down a giant demon without getting hit once, that feels pretty great. But
I'm trying to think of the correct terminology, but I'm just going to go classic here and go, what's your preferred class?
Well, I haven't got one, right? Because you can pretty much make any starting class into what you want. Basically, this class is at the start. They're kind of to get you through the first part. I've got three characters on the go right now because I was going through it. First, I chose a warrior because I would have a shield. But then I realized, oh, I don't really need a shield. And I wish I'd put more stats into dexterity so I could roll instead of strength for big weapons. So I went back and I started another character when I was halfway through on one. So I started playing those two like alongside each other at different points. And then I thought, I really need a sorcerer as well. I need to throw spells at people. So I went right back and I made a sorceress. And I've got three at different points in the game. And you can take the... When you finish the game, you can go then into a new game plus, which is a bit more difficult. So I'm still using the one that I completed the game with. So yeah, I've just got this family of characters and we're all very happy together.
Almost like The Sims.
Yeah. Only like more death than The Sims, at least more death than I played it. Well, maybe,
because I only played The Sims once and my kitchen caught fire and the mum died. And then all the dad and kids would do was sit around and cry. So
yeah, you have to move your remains outside the house to help create a graveyard in order for full bereavement counselling.
So you like bury the mum in the backyard? Like...
Yeah, that's pretty much how you deal with it.
See, Dark Souls is not as traumatic as that.
That's a brilliant quote.
What version of Sims were you playing?
I don't know. It was a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago. I don't know.
If it was that long, it would have been like the first one.
It was, very old Sims. Yeah. But see, I've got children and a house, so I don't really enjoy that kind of game.
Yeah.
Because that's my life.
Yeah.
So I like games where I can like hurt things, you know.
At this point, I would like to point out that Sims 4 has been announced to be on show at E3 this year. And I'd also like to point out that I suspect that the only step this game can now take, this game series, is that the micromanagement will move to the intestinal sort of level and be controlling bacteriums along with bowel movements. That's the only place they've got left to go. I got so fed up with 3. Like, Paul bought it for me thinking that I was going to love it.
Well, not that you're necessarily going to love it, just that, you know, you've played the previous ones and, have had a good time on them.
Certainly the first one. 2 was a bit... I never got quite the chance to get it into it. And then you got me 3. And I was just like, I can't control so many things. I can't deal with this anymore. The first game's classic. But Cookie, what have you been up to?
I've been watching Arrow.
You've been loving the Arrow?
I have been loving the Arrow, yeah. Absolutely. Fucking amazing show. Definitely. The origin story, a bit like Smallville of Green Arrow. And it's fucking amazing. And it makes Smallville look crapper and crapper every week.
Am I right in thinking that it's meant to be tying in with the Justice League-esque film that's coming out? Or is that...
There is rumours that it's supposed to be. I mean, they are certainly getting a lot of more nods towards other DC characters.
Okay.
The other week you had the Suicide Squad in it, which was just an immense episode. It was just really cool. You've had Huntress in there. We've got Sarah, who's Black Canary as well, who's a regular now. And we've also had the origin, well, the beginnings of the origin of Mr. Barry Allen, The Flash.
Nice.
Yay.
Which is it, a second season that year? On?
It is the second season that I am glued to every Thursday at 8 o'clock. That's in the summer work.
Which channel, which Sky channel's that?
Sky One.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah. We've still got Arrow season one sitting on the shelf over there on Blu-ray.
No, you've got to watch. Have you watched it yet?
No, not yet. It's still wrapped up in cellophane, much like our Lego Marvels for the Wii.
The Twitter account for them criticised you the other week over that. Well, at least it was kind of like criticised.
To be fair, it was a legitimate criticism. I haven't actually opened it up yet.
They were like, step one.
Yes.
It'll keep, it'll still be amazing exactly. In a month.
It doesn't have an expiry date.
No.
But seriously, if you get a chance to watch The Arrow, definitely watch the first season. But the first season, I found sort of the first two or three episodes a bit slow to get into it. Okay. And then the more you invest into it, the more you get out of it, because the more kicks you get out of it. It's a lot darker than Smallville.
Yeah. Nothing can be as slow as season one of Heroes.
No. True. This is very true. It's not as slow as that.
To be honest, I felt the first time while watching through Fringe, the first couple of episodes didn't really seem to go anywhere. And then it started to like heat up after a couple of episodes. And
I think with TV shows, sometimes you have to do that. It's a slow burner.
Mm.
You know.
Which is what everyone's been saying about S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
I held my hands up. S.H.I.E.L.D. last week rocked.
Yeah, I think S.H.I.E.L.D.'s been rocking more recently.
It has, yeah. But it's still nowhere near as good as Arrow.
No, man.
So, definitely get to watch that. I mean, it's just... you got Deathstroke in there as well at the moment.
Mm, nice.
He was just awesome. Complete with swords. Yay! Not by, obviously, that. Not that I actually, you know, obviously, I don't like to play with swords myself.
Well, no, you'll end up, you know, missing limbs.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I'm useless with a cigarette.
It would be hard not to just chop things, though, wouldn't it? I've got this sword, and like, what can I chop with it? I can chop my veg, and you know, I could just like maybe chop the door a little bit.
The video of the machete dude.
Oh yes, the bartender.
It's like, what can we cut with a machete? Yeah, we could cut limes with a machete. We could also cut open our legs. And this being America, that's obviously still very bloody, but be very bloody expensive. So.
I hope it was worth
expensive.
It.
Yeah, I went there.
That's terrible.
I know.
You're terrible.
Do you want to tell me about what you've been watching? And tell something everyone else.
I've been watching, it's like the first episode of the new season of Dara O'Brien's School of Hard Sums.
That's probably the most nerdy thing I want to say.
I know I am quite nerdy when it comes to like science and maths a little bit, but yeah, it's I like that type of thing. I mean, there has been a series from Dara O'Brien as well, which is more kind of science and kind of innovation and whatnot, and that was actually cool as well. He is my kind of nerd idol.
He's your nerd idol
at the moment, yeah. And even though I'm nowhere near as good at maths to actually, you know, kind of even kind of be on the show that much, I still like to kind of watch to see how they kind of work through things and see where kind of examples can be applied to the real world and stuff. And it's actually quite worrying the amount of like TV comedians that kind of go on there and they're like either anti-maths or they just have no idea, and it's like I'm kind of worried now. Why is maths such
a skill lacking in British comedians?
Yes, well, not just British comedians, to be fair,
the general public,
like podcasters.
I can do maths. It takes a very long time, though.
It's practice, though, isn't it? With maths, you forget it quite easily, I find.
Especially if you've got calculator.
I got mistaught maths in college, and all the progress I managed to make at GCSE was completely undone.
I think part of the problem with maths is that it's not taught in a relevant way. And I think that's one of the things that School of Hard Sums actually tries to set out to basically provide examples of how you can use maths in everyday. It's a bit like why I like numbers recently. Been watching that, and you know, that uses maths and kind of concepts within maths to kind of solve, you know, kind of crimes and whatnot that couldn't otherwise be solved.
Like when you're playing Hearthstone, I've noticed I need to like subtract 4 from 7 all the time. That's like
4 from 7. Oh, that's, yes, yeah, so it'd be 3 all the time.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so myself, I've been watching House of Cards, which has very little to do with maths, despite, you know, the fact that it's, you know, House of Cards, you know. But at the same time, is one of the things I'm happy to support with an increase in my subscription fees to Netflix, if it means more Kevin Spacey being an asshole American politician worming his way through the White House.
So I think you should say Kevin Spacey plays an asshole rather than is an asshole
politician. I was just keeping after this argument.
Okay, his character Frank Underwood is
Is he the baddie?
He is an anti-hero. He does some things that are kind of good for his country after becoming vice president. His journey to position of vice president was messy.
Mm.
There may have been bodies involved.
Oh.
Plural. And he is kind of like, you like the character because he's just so deliciously conniving.
Yeah.
And duplicitous that you kind of just, you're like, the people that can't see through him or the people that kind of see him for what he really is, you're kind of like, nah, we want Frank to go on because he's so evil, he's good.
Yeah, I love those.
We actually did an article about that recently as well.
Did you?
Yeah. See, this is what happens when you have over 250 posts. On a website. It's like, oh yeah, we talked about that. But no, I think the one thing that because I haven't been watching it with Emily, but I've been catching like bits and dabs, and one of the things that I do actually like about the series is that Kevin Spacey's character breaks the fourth wall quite often, so he talks directly to you, you know, kind of about the situation.
And he does it in this deliciously posh southern accent. It's amazing.
He doesn't break character.
It's just so cool.
It's actually on my list of the next thing to watch because everyone's been talking about it and I know very little, so that's probably the best way to go into it.
To be honest, I think even the stuff on Netflix, you know, we've got stuff piling up that we're going to waiting to watch, as well as kind of physical kind of DVDs and whatnot, as well as games as well.
I mean, I had been in the past week also watching a lot of 24, but on Sunday I was just like, you know what, I think I want political maneuvering rather than things going boom and shots being fired.
You want Oliver Stone verse rather than Michael Bay.
It felt a bit like that, yeah. It really did. Mind you, I mean, you know, JFK, there's still guns in that, so just not base explosions.
No, that would have been a very different film.
But, because obviously House of Cards, so it's not just a Netflix, well, you say Netflix original series, it's not really a Netflix original series because it's an adaptation of a British novel based on goings on between our own politicians and Parliament, Whitehall and House of Lords, and the subsequent BBC television adaptation. That was done, I think, in either the 80s or 90s. She says, and the people behind that have got, ooh, I believe,
flashbacks now.
Executive. They've got executive producer status on the Netflix Kevin Spacey adaptation, and Spacey's an executive producer on the Netflix adaptation as well. And it's the fact that, I mean, obviously you've got Frank Underwood's character, but you've got his wife. Is it Claire? I'm trying to remember fictional names here, which is hard for me.
Considering you can't usually remember real names.
Yeah. So his wife is quite a character as well. And perhaps not as conniving as Frank, but she will take steps to further her own ends. You know, she's quite manipulative as well, but in a sort of a different way.
It does make me wonder, because, I mean, you describe manipulative and whatnot. In comparison to the first three seasons of 24, when there was the president and he had his wife that was kind of manipulative and conniving, what's the difference between them, would you say?
I would say that it's harder to see Frank Underwood's manipulations in comparison to Sherry's in the first three seasons of 24. It's pretty obvious what Sherry's up to.
Mm.
And you can't, you know, like, everything she does, she's quite always clearly trying to cover her own back and get something at the same time.
Okay.
So, whereas with Frank, because he manages to buy a lot of people in with a sort of like false honesty. It's just not necessarily like lies, but he comes off as incredibly honest.
And presumably that means that he's far more charismatic as well.
Yeah, he's very charismatic. People buy into his kind of southern charm, basically.
Did you say that he was like a Democrat in it?
Yeah, he's like a Democrat in Carolina, like North or South Carolina state, sort of county area, whatever. Yeah. It's like, he's like, I think he does say at some point that that's like an oxymoron and he's aware of this. Which is quite funny. But yeah, so I think more people should watch House of Cards and make Netflix realise that original series are good.
Hey, did you know that there's 52 cards in a deck and there's 52 weeks in a year?
Yeah.
Sorry, just a bit of maths for you there.
I didn't know there were 52 cards in a deck.
Does this include...
I'm pretty sure. Now you've got to be questioning myself.
I think it also, there's definitely over 50, and it's under 55.
No, it's 52, because you have, including like ace to 10, that's 10 there, and then the three suits, that's 13. 13 times 4 is 56.
You said 56. So.
52, not 56. Oh, God.
See, numbers, it's just not fun, is it?
Maths gone wrong.
Numbers game.
It's not for the sake of maths that one should watch House of Cards. However, if you want to try and figure out how realistic the political scenarios are that arise in the series, some of it does involve math, because they're looking at percentages for like GDP and stuff, or whether or not breaking a trade agreement will send them up the, you know, up Chip Creek without a paddle kind of deal.
Up what creek?
I don't want to say it out
up
loud.
Up Poop Creek.
Yeah. Okay,
that makes it sound even worse.
It does a bit. It does a bit. Okay, well, now it's time for my interview with Opposable Games' Nat Al Tahan. Hi, and welcome to Nerds Assemble's interview with Nat Al Tahan. She's the Director of 2D Art and User Interface at Bristol game developers Opposable Games. Thank you so much for joining us, Nat.
Thank you. Pleasure's mine.
Okay, so we've got got some questions for you today for this lovely interview. First being, I'd love to know, would you be able to describe to our audience the kinds of games Opposable have previously worked on? Because I know you've got a big project going on at the moment, and I want to work up to getting you to describe that one.
Yeah, sure thing. So Opposable Games is 2.5 years old. There are 12 of us now. And we've got a real mixed bag of sort of our own IP and work for hire games that span genres from like top-down racing to point-and-click adventure to RTS and tower defense. So like on the one hand, we've made TV tie-ins for shows like Embarrassing Bodies, but we've also been involved with science and research-based games for institutions like the Wellcome Trust and Bristol University. And now we're working on Salvaged, which is rooted in, you know, traditional sci-fi. So we've got a team whose experience and expertise cover a lot of different areas, and what that allows is us to explore, you know, quite a massive range of genres.
Brilliant. So you mentioned Salvage, and you Opposable launched a Kickstarter funding drive for that recently. So is this Opposable's first sort of wholly creator-owned IP, and could you please describe the game for our listeners?
Salvaged isn't our first IP, but it is our first go at Kickstarter campaign, which is obviously a completely different sort of approach to every other avenue of funding. Salvaged is a real-time tactical action game set in the sci-fi universe, but the unique aspect is it's for dual screens. So your setup would be you play simultaneously on your PC or Mac and mobile device. In our latest update, we actually announced that due to popular demand, we're now going to support a virtual multi-screen environment and dual-screen PC and Oculus Rift 2. So the game is you play as a commander of a remote interstellar salvage crew, or RISC crew, and control a team of four in a top-down tactical view from your tablet or smartphone while watching through your team's shoulder cams on PC. So the idea is to loot black boxes and whatever else you can find from derelict spaceships while shooting aliens in the face and not dying. Ships are procedurally generated, and the game features permadeath as well, so it's all quite fraught and fast-paced.
That sounds pretty intense. Oh my goodness. I do like the dual-screen aspect, though. I'd like to ask, what's it like as a company to be working a lot of time on other sort of person's IPs, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, sure. So it depends on the IP. It can be hugely rewarding to add value to an existing property that you can get excited about, especially if it's their first foray into games, as was the case with Embarrassing Bodies. Although, having said that, the things the artist and I had to Google to get that game done will haunt my dreams forever. So there is that. Getting to develop your own IP is the holy grail for most indie developers, I think. But work for hire doesn't have to be soul-sucking, you know. And if you get the balance right, it should enable exploration of your own ideas while keeping the company afloat.
There's been a lot said recently about the criteria for the games tax relief that's coming in the UK. What do you think of the criteria that has been put forward?
I think we've all breathed a sigh of relief as developers that tax breaks have finally been approved. You know, it's been a long time coming, and, you know, just it wasn't mentioned for so long, and that was obviously quite worrying. So it's good news for devs on the whole. Most of the criteria are reasonable, like having dialogue in English and development taking place in the UK. I think the one that makes people laugh is obviously the cultural contribution one, which gives you points for games that reflect British heritage, as if we're all going to go out now and make games about shooting crumpets out of the sky with teabag launchers, which actually I wouldn't say no to making that, but that's what seems to be the one people pick up on.
I remember trying to suggest that, because obviously you know, like you got Rocksteady over here and developing like the Batman games, and that due to the fact that they've got Alfred in it, they could perhaps, you know, have that cultural angle.
Yeah, that's totally legit.
Which is crazy. But at the same time, will Opposable be able to benefit from the game's tax relief?
Yeah, I mean, Opposable is a studio, and our games currently in development certainly meet enough criteria to qualify for tax relief. You know, all our development is UK-based. And things like our voice actor for Commander Alex in Salvaged is an English lady, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Brilliant. How did you get into games development?
So I studied video game design at uni too many years ago. But when I graduated before mobile was really a platform people developed games for, before indie studios, you know, really got going. So I actually ended up as a graphic designer for print and web for a few years. And then after that, I freelanced design and illustration. And I sort of, you know, I loved those things and that was awesome, but my heart was in games. And after a while, I started to see sort of a few games events start to spring up around Bristol or around the Southwest, really. And I started going to games jams and stuff, which is actually how all the directors at Opposable met. Design director James and I had met at one game jam beforehand, but it was at a Next Play game jam that the five of us met for the first time. And the rest is, of course, history. Although I still freelance design and illustration, actually, because I still really enjoy that work. And I'm an advocate of multidisciplinary skill sets. I think having a variety of skills and experiences is a really strong position to be in. So, yeah.
That's, again, intense. which video game has inspired you the most?
Oh, dude. That is a really hard question. That's between babies. I think that the easiest way to answer that is with the game that got me interested in games in the first place, which is Sonic 1 on the Master System. And I just, after I play that game, I draw him and my own characters for the Sonic universe just endlessly. And I think, you know, that gave me actually a clarity of ambition at quite a young age. I knew that's what I wanted to do. And just generally, yeah, it tends to be character-led games that grab my attention, like Oddworld. I have an Oddworld art book full of creature concepts, and I think they're just the most wonderful drawings and ideas and expressions of ideas. And if there's one game I wish I'd made, it would be Pokemon, because I could draw Pokemon forever.
I remember getting into Pokemon before the games came out. It was a strange experience of kind of like being aware of the anime and waiting for the anime to start showing on Sky, and I'd go over to my granddad's to watch it because he was the one in the family that had Sky. But the only reason I knew that the series existed was because I saw this bizarre pull-out poster in all magazines, Shout, the girls' mag. And it was a poster for you to keep track of, like, spotting all the various Pokemon in the course of all the episodes.
Oh, that's wicked.
And there was, like, a little sort of, like, poster address saying, if you send a bit of, you know, send a... oh, like an envelope or whatever to this address, Sky will send you a full poster. So I ended up with I think it was an A2 Pokemon poster of the original 150, because it was, obviously Mew wasn't, like, revealed until the first film. So, yeah,
That's wicked. It's nice to have those first... I think when a game lodges in your brain like that, or a sort of a brand lodges in your brain like that, that's so awesome. Well, I remember my first encounter with Pokemon was the anime as well. And I remember distinctly being a kid and sort of hearing something come on in the background that I didn't know, so I wasn't interested. And I was halfway up the stairs, and the stairs sort of were side onto the TV. And then as I was walking up the stairs, I was kind of watching, and Pikachu came on the screen. And then I kind of slowed down, and then I remember ending up just, like, with my face in between the banisters as this tiny kid, just staring for half an hour watching this show, and then having to peel my face off the banisters. And, yeah, that was that, really. I was in.
I may have at one point, like, the summer, like, just at, like, after the anime kind of got big over here, I think I made... It wasn't GeoCities, it was...
Angel Fires?
No, it wasn't. It was something else that I think was partially tied in somewhere to Time Warner. Somebody like that had, like, a you could build your own fan site thing, and I made a little Pokemon one, and it's like tried to. And this is obviously web, not 2.0, and sort of like trying to put GIFs on pages and stuff. And it was
insane. Oh man, scrolling marquees. That's what it was all about. Like, everything flashed, like music that played, and you couldn't turn it off. That was my generation of web, dude. It's awesome.
Go back to a slightly more serious note, though,
for yes.
the moment. What do you think stops women today entering the UK video games industry in terms of the creative and coding side?
Oh, I always find these questions hard. And there are women in gaming who are far more knowledgeable and eloquent about the issues than I am, like Lara Lynn McWilliams and Leigh Alexander. I think, though, that university is too late for getting into games generally. In my opinion, all kids should be taught how to code at primary school, and from the creative side, if they want their art project to be designing video game characters, then for that to be academically legitimate and encouraged instead of the kind of derision it normally attracts. This is, you know, an issue. I know that's not a very woman-specific opinion, but my opinions generally aren't, actually. I've seen some women's only games events and things going on, and while I can see what they're trying to do, to me, segregation is never the long-term solution. You know, girls and boys need to be able to grow up in a world where their ambitions and their skill sets are unrelated to their gender. Video games aren't for boys, and no one's born with stigma and prejudice. It's a cultural problem, and it extends beyond our industry. And that's where it needs to be addressed, I think.
Fair enough, definitely. Completely agree with that. Okay, well then, following on from that, any advice for our listeners who may be interested in trying to get into the video games industry?
Yeah, I mean, from my own experience, you will not be surprised to hear that I am a huge advocate of games jams as an entry point. And there are more and more, and they're just awesome. It's a unique opportunity to not only mix with game devs of various levels of experience, but to also work alongside them on what is essentially sort of a sprint prototyping development. You walk away also with a tangible product to show people and to include in your portfolio if you're an artist. You know, if you're an artist who can't code, for example, it can really give you the edge when presenting your portfolio to be able to show, you know, a working game. It puts you in you know, a really strong position.
Okay. Well, but for those of us who aren't as technical, I mean, I'm somebody who's like, I do writing a lot, and I made my first twine the other month. It was short but sweet and had several different paths. But I mean, because I've always wondered, like, for somebody like me who isn't necessarily somebody who's going to do artwork or whatever, is there a place for people who can plan well in a game jam?
Yeah, I mean, often in games jams, I mean, probably over half the game jams I've been involved with, we've had a project manager, you know, role in the jam, and whether that will be somebody who's sort of combining the game design element with project management, or games writing element with project management, then, you know, there are roles, you know, it's not just art and coding and sound. There are roles, not ancillary to that, but outside of that, that can really contribute. And, you know, that if also if you come in with a skill that's kind of unique or a little bit different, the game jam is an experimental, you know, just by its nature is experimental. So if you come in with those skills, just get a group on board who are interested in that, and they will build something around, you know, whatever's in the party, whatever skills you bring.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, and finally, please tell our listeners in 30 seconds or less why they should back the Salvaged Kickstarter.
Okay, back it because you like it. I mean, if you're a fan of games like Space Hulk, XCOM, FTL, then there's a good chance Salvaged will be up your street. There's loads of video and art and information on the Kickstarter page, which you can get to from salvagedgame.com. Plus, there's cool rewards like putting your face on a Risk team member and 3D printed models and stuff like that. You know, we're working really hard to make sure that the dual screen thing really enhances the experience without feeling gimmicky. So you'd be backing this kind of unique way of playing the game as well.
You've had your 30 seconds.
You tried to cut me off there. I'm sorry.
No, that's lovely. It does definitely sound and look like, I've had a look around the Kickstarter, it definitely looks like an interesting project. So I am vaguely tempted, I have to admit, to back it. Mostly because of the dual screen aspect. You know, that's something, because every time everyone keeps talking about dual screen, because I'm in the marketing end of my professional life, and it's just like, oh, it's about trying to target people whilst they're looking at their phone, whilst watching House of Cards or something.
Yeah,
it's like no dual screen where you're actually using the phone to actively interact with the entertainment you're partaking in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's about making it that integral experience instead of just kind of a peripheral. And the thing about it as well is we're using devices that people have anyway. You know, there's people who obviously have piped up and said, no, we want virtual multi-screen, we want dual screen on PC and things like that, but you know, at the end of the day, you've got these devices. The vast majority of people have got these devices. And when the most you ask them to do is tweet when they're watching TV, it's really not making use of the technology that, you know, is already in people's hands. So it should be really good.
Well, that's brilliant. Well, thank you, Nat, for speaking with us for this episode.
Thank you. It's been awesome.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. So it's goodbye from...
Laura Rich, Rapture Leaking.
And it's good night for me, Paul, a.k.a. OneArmed_Cookie. And you can also find me lurking around at GameJar.com.
And it's good night for me, Paul Blurt, and I'm on Twitter, just under Paul Blurt.
And it's good night for me, Emily King. You find me on Twitter as EK6891. You can find Nerds Assemble over at www.nerdsassemble.co.uk. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher. We're on Twitter as Nerds Podcast, plus we're on Facebook and Google Plus as Nerds Assemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out hexdimensioning.com. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
63.